console, its Durasteel housing buckling under his grip.
This is my answer.
He ripped the console wholly into the air, right out from under the hands of the astonished Nymordian operator, raised it over his head, and hurled it at the Jedi. They split, rolling out of the console's way as it crashed the deck, spitting smoke and sparks.
Open fire!
Grievous shook his fists as though each held a Jedi's neck.
Kill them! Kill them all!
For one more second, there was only the scuttle of priming levers on dozens of blasters. One second after that, the bridge exploded into a firestorm. Grievous hung back, crouching, watching for a moment as his two Magna Guards waded into the Jedi, electro-staffs whirling through the blinding hail of blaster fire that ricocheted around the bridge. Grievous had fought Jedi before, sometimes even in open battle, and he had found that fighting any one Jedi was much like fighting any other. Kenobi, though, the ease with which Kenobi had taken command of the situation was frightening. More frightening was the fact that of the two, Skywalker was reportedly the greater warrior. And even their R2 unit could fight. The little astromech had some kind of aftermarket cable gun it had used to entangle the legs of a super droid and yank it off its feet, and now was jerking the droid this way and that so that its arm cannons were blasting chunks off its squad mates instead of the Jedi. Grievous was starting to think less about winning this particular encounter than about surviving it. Let his Magna Guards fight the Jedi. That's what they were designed for. And they were doing their jobs well. IG-101 had pressed Kenobi back against the console, lightning blazing from his electrostaff's energy shield where it pushed on Kenobi's blade. The Jedi General might have died then and there, except that one of the simple-minded super battle droids turned both arm cannons on his back, giving Kenobi the chance to duck and allow the hammering blaster bolts to slam 101 stumbling backward. Skywalker had stashed the Chancellor somewhere. That sniveling coward Palpatine was probably trembling under one of the control consoles and had managed to sever both of 102's legs below the knee, which for some reason he apparently expected to end the fight. He seemed completely astonished when 102 whirled nimbly on one end of his electro staff and used the stumps of his legs to thump Skywalker so soundly the Jedi went down skidding. On the other hand, Grievous thought, this might be salvageable after all. He tapped his internal comlink's jaw sensor to the general droid command frequency.
The Chancellor is hiding under one of the consoles. Squad 16, find him and deliver him to my escape pod immediately. Squad 8, stay on mission. Kill the Jedi.
Then the ship bucked, sharper than it ever had, and the view wall panels whited out as radiation scatter sleeted through the bridge. Alarm klaxons blared. The nav console flared sparks into the face of an Nymoidian pilot, setting his uniform on fire and adding his screams to the din. And another console exploded, ripping the newly promoted senior gunnery officer into a pile of shredded meat. Ah, Grievous thought. In all the excitement, he had entirely forgotten about Lieutenant Commander Nida and integrity. The other pilot, the one who wasn't shrieking and slapping at the flames on his uniform until his own hands caught fire, leaned as far away from his screaming partner as his crash webbing would allow, and shouted,
"General! That shot destroyed the last of the aft control cells! The ship is de-orbiting! We're going to burn!"
"Very well,"
Grievous said calmly.
"Stay on course."
Now it no longer mattered whether his bodyguards could overpower the Jedi or not. They would all burn together. He tapped his jaw sensor to the control frequency for the escape pods. One coded order ensured that his personal pod would be waiting for him, with engines hot and systems checks complete. When he looked back to the fight, all he could see of IG-102 was one arm, the saber-cut joint still white-hot. Skywalker was pursuing two super battle droids that had Palpatine by the arms. While Skywalker dismantled the droids with swift cuts, Kenobi was in the process of doing the same to IG-101. The Magna Guard was hopping on its one remaining leg, whirling its electro staff with one remaining arm, and screeching some improbable threat regarding its staff and Kenobi's body cavities.
And after Kenobi cut off the arm, 101 went hopping after him, still screeching. The droid actually managed to land one glancing kick before the Jedi casually severed its other leg, after which 101's limbless torso continued to writhe on the deck, howling. With both Magna Guards down, all eight destroyers opened up, dual cannons erupting gouts of galvaned particle beams. The two Jedi leapt together to screen the Chancellor, and before Grievous could command the destroyers to cease fire, the Jedi had deflected enough of the bolts to blow apart three-quarters of the remaining super battle droids and send the survivors scurrying for cover beside what was left of the cringing Nymoidians. The destroyers began to close in, hosing down the Jedi with heavy fire, advancing step by step, cannons against lightsabers. The Jedi caught every blast and sent them back against the destroyer shields that flared in spherical halos as they absorbed the reflected bolts. The destroyers might very well have prevailed over the Jedi, except for one unexpected difficulty. Gravity shear. All eight of them suddenly seemed inexplicably to leap into the air, followed by Skywalker and Palpatine, and chairs and pieces of Magna Guards, and everything else on the bridge that was not bolted to the deck. Except for Kenobi, who managed to grab a control console, and now was hanging by one hand upside down, still effortlessly deflecting blaster bolts. The surviving Nymoidian pilot was screaming orders for the droids to magnetize, then started howling that the ship was breaking up, and managed to make so much annoying noise that Grievous smashed his skull out of simple irritation. Then he looked around and realized he'd just killed the last of his crew. All the bridge crew he hadn't slain personally had sucked up the bulk of the random blaster ricochets. Grievous shook the pilot's brains off his fist. Disgusting creatures, Nymoidians. The invisible plane of altered gravity passed over the biodroid general without effect. His talons of magnetized uranium kept him right where he was, and as one of the Magna Guard's electrostaffs fell past him, his invisibly fast hand snatched it from the air. When another plane of gravity shear swept through the bridge, droids, Chancellor, and Jedi all fell back to the floor. Though the Droidica, also known as the Destroyer Droid, was the most powerful infantry combat droid in general production, it had one major design flaw. The energy shield that was so effective in stopping blasters, slugs, shrapnel, and even lightsabers was precisely tuned to englobe the droid in a standing position. If the droid was no longer standing, say if it was knocked down or thrown into a wall, the shield generator could not distinguish a floor or a wall from a weapon, and would keep ramping up power to disintegrate this perceived threat until the generator shorted itself out. Between falling to the ceiling, bouncing off it, and falling back to the floor, the sum total output of all the shield generators of Squad 8 was currently one large cloud of black smoke. It was impossible to say which one of them opened fire on the Jedi, and it didn't matter. Inside of 2 seconds, eight droidicas had become eight piles of smoking scrap, and two Jedi, entirely unscathed, walked out of the smoke, side by side. Without a word, they parted to bracket the general. Grievous clicked the electrostaff's power setting to overload. It spat lightning around him as he lifted it to combat ready.
I am sorry I don't have time to fight you. It would have been an interesting match. But I have an appointment with an escape pod. And you.
He pointed at the transparisteel view wall and triggered his own concealed cable gun, not unlike the one that fancy astromech of theirs had. The cable shot out and its grappling claw buried itself in one of the panel supports.
You have appointments with death.
The Jedi leapt, and Grievous hurled the overloading electrostaff, but not at the Jedi. He threw it at a window. One of the transparisteel panels of the view wall had cracked under a glancing hit from a starfighter's cannon. When the sparking electrostaff hit it squarely and exploded like a proton grenade, the whole panel blew out into space. A hurricane roared to life, raging through the bridge, seizing Nymoidian corpses and pieces of droids and wreckage and hurling them out through the gap, along with a white fountain of flash-frozen air.
Grievous sprang straight up into the instant hurricane, narrowly avoiding the two Jedi, whose leaps had become frantic tumbles as they tried to avoid being sucked through along with him. Grievous, though, had no need to breathe, nor had he any fear of his body fluids boiling in the vacuum. The pressurized synth flesh that enclosed the living parts within his droid exoskeleton saw to that. So he simply rode the storm right out into space until he reached the end of the cable and it snapped tight and swung him whipping back toward Invisible Hand's hull. He cast off the cable. His hands and feet of magnetized uranium let him scramble along the hull without difficulty, the light spidered curve of Coruscant's nightside whirling around him. He clambered over to the external locks of the bridge escape pods and punched in a command code. Looking back over his shoulder, he experienced a certain chilly satisfaction as he watched empty escape pods blast free of the Hand's bridge and streak away. All of them. Well, all but one. No trick of the Force would spring Kenobi and Skywalker out of this one. It was a shame he didn't have a spy probe handy to leave on the bridge. He would have enjoyed watching the Republic's greatest heroes burn. The ion streaks of the escape pods spiraled through the battle that still flashed and flared silently in the void, pursued by starfighters and armed retrieval ships. Grievous nodded to himself. That should occupy them long enough for his command pod to make the run to his escape ship. As he entered his customized pod, he reflected that he was, for the first time in his career, violating orders. Though he was under strict orders to leave the Chancellor unharmed, Palpatine was about to die alongside his precious Jedi. Then Grievous shrugged and sighed. What more could he have done? There was a war on, after all. He was sure Lord Sidious would forgive him. On the bridge, a blast shield had closed over the destroyed transparasteel window, and every last surviving combat model droid had been cut to pieces even before the atmosphere had had a chance to stabilize. But there was a more serious problem. The bucking of the ship had become continuous. White-hot sparks outside streamed backward past the view wall windows. Those sparks, according to the three different kinds of alarms that were all screaming through the bridge at once, were what was left of the ablative shielding on the nose of the disabled cruiser. Anakin stared grimly down at a console readout. All the escape pods are gone. Not one left in the whole ship. He looked up at Obi-Wan. We're trapped. Obi-Wan appeared more interested than actually concerned. Well, here's a chance to display your legendary piloting skills, my young friend. You can fly this cruiser, can't you? Flying's no problem. The trick is landing, Anakin gave a slightly shaky laugh. Which, you know, this cruiser is not exactly designed to do, even when it's in one piece. Obi-Wan looked unimpressed. And so? Anakin unsnapped the crash webbing that held the pilot's corpse and pulled the body from its chair. And so, you'd better strap in, he said, settling into the chair, his fingers sliding over the unfamiliar controls. The cruiser bounced even harder, and its attitude began to skew as a new klaxon joined the blare of the other alarms. That wasn't me! Anakin jerked his hands away from the board. I haven't even done anything yet. It certainly wasn't. Palpatine's voice was unnaturally calm. It seems someone is shooting at us. Wonderful, Anakin muttered. Could this day get any better? Perhaps we can talk with them. Obi-Wan moved over to the comm station and began working the screen. Let them know we've captured the ship. All right, take the comm, Anakin said. He pointed at the co-pilot station. R2, second chair. Chancellor?
Yes?
Strap in. Now. We're going in hot. Anakin grimaced at the scraps of burning hull flashing past the view wall. In more ways than one. The vast space battle that had ripped and battered Coruscant space all this long, long day finally began to flicker out. The shimmering canopy of ion trails and turbo laser bursts was fading into streaks of ships achieving jump as the Separatist strike force fled in full retreat. The light of Coruscant's distant star splintered through iridescent clouds of gas crystals that were the remains of starfighters and of pilots. Damaged cruisers limped toward space yards, passing shattered hulks that hung dead in the infinite day that is interplanetary space. Prize crews took command of surrendered ships, imprisoning the living among their crews and affixing restraining bolts to the droids. The dayside surface of the capital planet was shrouded in smoke from a million fires, touched off by meteorite impacts of ship fragments. Far too many had fallen to be tracked and destroyed by the planet's surface defense umbrella. The nightside sheet of artificial lights faded behind the red-white glow from craters of burning steel. Each impact left a caldera of unimaginable death. In the skies of Coruscant now, the important vessels were no longer warships, but were instead the fire suppression and rescue craft that crisscrossed the planet. Now, one last fragmentary ship screamed into the atmosphere, coming in too fast, too steep, pieces breaking off to spread apart and stream their own contrails of superheated vapor. Banks of turbolasers on the surface defense towers isolated their signature, and starfighters whipped onto interception courses to thin out whatever fragments the SD towers might miss. And far above, beyond the atmosphere, on the bridge of RSS Integrity, Lieutenant Commander Lorth Nida spoke urgently to a knee-high blue ghost scanned into existence by the phased array lasers in a holocom. An alien in Jedi robes, with bulging eyes set in a wrinkled face and long, pointed, oddly flexible ears.
"You have to stand down the surface defense system, sir. It's General Kenobi," Nida insisted. "His code verifies. Skywalker is with them, and they have Chancellor Palpatine."
"Heard and understood this is,"
the Jedi responded calmly.
"Tell me what they require."
Nida glanced down at the boil of hull plating that was burning off the falling cruiser, and even as he looked, the ship broke in half at the hangar deck. The rear half tumbled, exploding in sections. But whoever was flying the front half must have been one of the greatest pilots Nida had ever even heard of. The front half wobbled and slewed, but somehow righted itself, using nothing but a bank of thrusters and its atmospheric drag fins.
"First, a flight of fire ships," Nida said more calmly now. "If they don't get the burn-off under control, there won't be enough hull left to make the surface. And a hardened docking platform, the strongest available. They won't be able to set it down. This won't be a landing. It will be a controlled crash. Repeat, a controlled crash."
"Heard and understood this is,"
the hologramic Jedi repeated.
"Cross-load their transponder signature."
When this was done, the Jedi nodded grave approval.
"Thank you, Lieutenant Commander. Valiant service for the Republic you have done today, and the gratitude of the Jedi Order you have earned. Yoda out."
On the Bridge of Integrity, Lorth Nida now could only stand and watch, hands clasped behind his back. Military discipline kept him expressionless, but pale bands began at his knuckles and spread whiteness nearly to his wrists. Every bone in his body ached with helplessness, because he knew that fragment of a ship was a death trap. No one could land such a hulk, not even Skywalker. Each second that passed before its final breakup and burn was a miracle in itself, a testament to the gifts of a pilot who was justly legendary. But when each second is a miracle, how many of them can be strung together in a row? Lorth Nida was not religious, nor was he a philosopher or metaphysician. He knew of the Force only by reputation, but nonetheless, now he found himself asking the Force in his heart that when the fiery end came for the men in that scrap of a ship, it might at least come quickly. His eyes stung. The irony of it burned the back of his throat. The home fleet had fought brilliantly, and the Jedi had done their superhuman part against all odds. The Republic had won the day. Yet this battle had been fought to save Supreme Chancellor Palpatine. They had won the battle. But now, as Nida stood watching helplessly, he couldn't help feeling that they were about to lose the war.
This
is Anakin Skywalker's masterpiece. Many people say he is the best star pilot in the galaxy, but that's merely talk. Born of the constant HoloNet references to his unmatched string of kills in starfighter combat. Blowing up vulture droids and tri-fighters is simply a matter of superior reflexes and trust in the Force. He has spent so many hours in the cockpit that he wears a Jedi starfighter like clothes. It's his own body, with thrusters for legs and cannons for fists. What he is doing right now transcends mere flying the way Jedi combat transcends a schoolyard scuffle. He sits in a blood-spattered, blaster-chopped chair behind a console he's never seen before. A console with controls designed for alien fingers. The ship he's in is not only bucking like a maddened dewback through brutal coils of clear air turbulence, it's on fire and breaking up like a comet ripping apart as it crashes into a gas giant. He has only seconds to learn how to maneuver an alien craft that not only has no aft control cells, but has no aft at all. This is, put simply, impossible. It can't be done. He's going to do it anyway, because he is Anakin Skywalker, and he doesn't believe in impossible. He extends his hands, and for one long, long moment, he merely strokes controls, feeling their shape under his fingers, listening to the shivers his soft touch brings to each remaining control surface of the disintegrating ship, allowing the resonances to join inside his head until they resolve into harmony, like a Faroan joy harp virtuoso, checking the tuning of his instrument. And at the same time, he draws power from the Force. He gathers perception and luck and sucks into himself the instinctive preconscious what will happen in the next 10 seconds intuition that has always been the core of his talent. And then he begins. On the downbeat, atmospheric drag fins deploy. As he tweaks their angles and cycles them in and out to slow the ship's descent without burning them off altogether, their contrabass roar takes on a punctuated rhythm like a heart that skips an occasional beat. The forward attitude thrusters, damaged in the ship-to-ship battle, now fire in random directions, but he can feel where they're taking him, and he strokes them in sequence, making their song the theme of his impromptu concerto. And the true inspiration, the sparkling grace note of genius that brings his masterpiece to life, is the soprano counterpoint, a syncopated sequence of exterior hatches in the outer hull, sliding open and closed and open again, subtly altering the aerodynamics of the ship to give it just exactly the amount of sideslip or lift or yaw to bring the huge half-cruiser into the approach cone of a pinpoint target an eighth of the planet away. It is the Force that makes this possible, and more than the Force. Anakin has no interest in serene acceptance of what the Force will bring. Not here. Not now. Not with the lives of Palpatine and Obi-Wan at stake. It's just the opposite. He seizes upon the Force with a stark refusal to fail. He will land this ship. He will save his friends. Between his will and the will of the Force, there is no contest. Part 2. Seduction. The dark is generous, and it is patient. It is the dark that seeds cruelty into justice, that drips contempt into compassion, that poisons love with grains of doubt. The dark can be patient, because the slightest drop of rain will cause those seeds to sprout. The rain will come, and the seeds will sprout, for the dark is the soil in which they grow, and it is the clouds above them, and it waits behind the star that gives them light. The dark's patience is infinite. Eventually, even stars burn out. Chapter 8. Fault Lines. Mace Windu hung on to the corrugated hatch grip beside the gunship's open troop bay with one hand, squinting into the wind that whipped his overcloak behind him. His other hand, shaded his eyes against the glare from one of the orbital mirrors that concentrated the capital planet's daylight. The mirror was slowly turning aside now, allowing a band of twilight to approach the gunship's destination. That destination, a kilometer-thick landing platform in the planet's vast industrial zone, was marked with a steeply slanting tower of smoke and vapor that stretched from the planet's surface to the uppermost reaches of the atmosphere, a tower that only now was beginning to spread and coil from its tiny source point to a horizon-spanning smear across the stratospheric winds. The gunship roared over the bottomless canyons of durasteel and permacrete that formed the landscape of Coruscant, arrowing straight for the industrial zone without regard for the rigid traffic laws that governed flight on the galactic planet. Until martial law was officially lifted by the Senate, the darkening skies would be traveled only by Republic military craft, Jedi transports, and emergency vehicles. The gunship qualified as all three. Mace could see the ship now, what was left of it, resting on the scorched platform far ahead. A piece of a ship, a fragment, less than a third of what once had been the Trade Federation flagship, still burning, despite the gouts of fire suppression foam raining down on it from five different ships, and the emergency support clone troops who surrounded it on the platform. Mace shook his head. Skywalker again. The Chosen One. Who else could have brought in this hulk? Who else could have even come close? The gunship swung into a hot landing, repulsors howling. Mace hopped out before it could settle and gave the pilot an open palm gesture to signal him to wait. The pilot, faceless within his helmet, responded with a closed fist. Though, of course, the pilot wasn't faceless at all. Under his armored helmet, that clone pilot had a face that Mace Windu remembered all too well. That face would always remind him that he had once held Dooku within his grasp and had let him slip away. Across the platform, an escape pod hatch cycled open. Emergency crews scrambled with an escape slide, and a moment later, the Supreme Chancellor, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Anakin Skywalker were all on the deck beside the burning ship, closely followed by a somewhat battered R2 unit that lifted itself down on customized maneuvering rockets. Mace strode swiftly out to meet them. Palpatine's robes were scorched and tattered at the hem, and he seemed weak. He leaned a bit on Skywalker's shoulder as they moved away from the ship. On Skywalker's other side, Master Kenobi seemed to touch the worse for wear himself, caked with dust and leaking a trickle of blood from a scalp wound. Skywalker, by contrast, looked every bit the Holonet hero he was supposed to be. He seemed to tower over his companions, as though he had somehow gotten even taller in the months since Mace had seen him last. His hair was tousled, his color was high, and his walk still had the grounded grace of a natural fighter. But there was something new in his physicality, in the way he moved his head, perhaps, or the way the weight of Palpatine's arm on his shoulder seemed somehow to belong there, or something less definable, some new ease, new confidence, an aura of inner power, presence. Skywalker was not the same young man the Council had sent off to the Outer Rim 5 standard months ago.
Chancellor, May said as he met them, are you well? Do you need medical attention?
He gestured over his shoulder at the waiting gunship.
I have a fully equipped field surgery.
No need, Palpatine said rather faintly. Thank you, Master Windu, but I am well. Quite well, thanks to these two.
Mace nodded.
Master Kenobi? Anakin?
Never better, Skywalker replied, looking as if he meant it. And Kenobi only shrugged with a slight wince as he touched his scalp wound. Only a bump on the head. That field surgery must be needed elsewhere.
It is.
Mace looked grim.
We don't even have a preliminary estimate of civilian casualties.
He waved off the gunship and it roared away toward the countless fires that painted red the approach of night.
A shuttle is on its way. Chancellor, we'll have you on the Senate floor within the hour. The Holonet has already been notified that you will want to make a statement.
I will. I will indeed.
Palpatine touched Mace on the arm.
You have always been of great value to me, Master Windu. Thank you.
The Jedi are honored to serve the Senate, sir.
There might have been the slightest emphasis on the word Senate. Mace remained expressionless as he subtly moved his arm away from the Chancellor's hand. He looked at Obi-Wan.
Is there anything else to report, Master Kenobi? What of General Grievous?
Count Dooku was there, Skywalker interjected. He had a look on his face that Mace couldn't decipher, proud yet wary, even unhappy. He's dead now.
Dead?
He looked from Anakin to Obi-Wan and back again.
Is this true? You killed Count Dooku?
My young friend is too modest. He killed Count Dooku. Smiling, Kenobi touched the lump on his head. I was taking a nap.
But...
Mace blinked. Dooku was to the Separatists what Palpatine was to the Republic. The center of gravity binding together a spiral galaxy of special interests. With Dooku gone, the Confederacy of Independent Systems would no longer really be a confederacy at all. They'd fly to pieces within weeks. Within days.
Mace said again, but...
And in the end, he couldn't think of a but.
This was all so astonishing that he very nearly, almost but not quite, cracked a smile. That is, he said, the best news I've heard since...
He shook his head.
Since I can't remember. Anakin, how did you do it?
Inexplicably, young Skywalker looked distinctly uncomfortable. That newly confident presence of his collapsed as suddenly as an overloaded deflector. And instead of meeting Mace's eyes, his gaze flicked to Palpatine. Somehow Mace didn't think this was modesty. He looked to the Chancellor as well, his elation sinking, becoming puzzlement, tinged with suspicion. It was entirely extraordinary, Palpatine said blandly, oblivious to Mace's narrowing stare. I know next to nothing of swordplay, of course. To my amateur's eye, it seemed that Count Dooku may have been a trace overconfident, especially after having disposed of Master Kenobi so neatly. Obi-Wan flushed just a bit, and Anakin flushed considerably more deeply. Perhaps young Anakin was simply more highly motivated, Palpatine said, turning a fond smile upon him. After all, Dooku was fighting only to slay an enemy. Anakin was fighting to save, if I may presume the honor, a friend. Mace's scowl darkened. Fine words. Perhaps even true words, but he still didn't like them. No one on the Jedi Council had ever been comfortable with Skywalker's close relationship with the Chancellor. They'd had more than one conversation about it with Obi-Wan while Skywalker had still been his Padawan, and Mace was less than happy to hear Palpatine speaking for a young Jedi who seemed unprepared to speak for himself. He said,
I'm sure the Council will be very interested in your full report, Anakin,
with just enough emphasis on full to get his point across. Skywalker swallowed, and then, just as suddenly as it had collapsed, that aura of calm, centered confidence rebuilt itself around him. Yes. Yes, of course, Master Windu. And we must report that Grievous escaped, Obi-Wan said. He is as cowardly as ever. Mace accepted this news with a nod.
But he is only a military commander. Without Dooku to hold the coalition together, these so-called independent systems will splinter, and they know it.
He looked straight into the Supreme Chancellor's eyes.
This is our best chance to sue for peace. We can end this war right now.
And while Palpatine answered, Mace Windu reached into the Force. To Mace's Force perception, the world crystallized around them, becoming a gem of reality shot through with flaws and fault lines of possibility. This was Mace's particular gift, to see how people and situations fit together in the Force, to find the sheer planes that can cause them to break in useful ways, and to intuit what sort of strike would best make the cut. Though he could not consistently determine the significance of the structures he perceived, the darkening cloud upon the Force that had risen with the rebirth of the Sith made that harder and harder with each passing day. The presence of shatter points was always clear.
Mace had supported the training of Anakin Skywalker, though it ran counter to millennia of Jedi tradition, because from the structure of fault lines in the Force around him, he had been able to intuit the truth of Qui-Gon Jinn's guess, that the young slave boy from Tatooine was in fact the prophesied chosen one, born to bring balance to the Force. He had argued for the elevation of Obi-Wan Kenobi to mastership, and to give the training of the Chosen One into the hands of this new, untested master, because his unique perception had shown him powerful lines of destiny that bound their lives together, for good or ill. On the day of Palpatine's election to the Chancellorship, he had seen that Palpatine was himself a shatterpoint of unimaginable significance, a man upon whom might depend the fate of the Republic itself. Now he saw the three men together, and the intricate lattice of fault lines and stress fractures that bound them each to the other was so staggeringly powerful that its structure was beyond calculation. Anakin was somehow a pivot point, the fulcrum of a lever, with Obi-Wan on one side, Palpatine on the other, and the galaxy in the balance. But the dark cloud on the Force prevented his perception from reaching into the future for so much as a hint of where this might lead. The balance was already so delicate that he could not guess the outcome of any given shift. The slightest tip in any direction would generate chaotic oscillation. Anything could happen. Anything at all. And the lattice of fault lines that bound all three of them to each other stank of the dark side. He lifted his head and looked to the sky, picking out the dropping star of the Jedi shuttle as it swung toward them through the darkening afternoon.
"I'm afraid peace is out of the question while Grievous is at large," the Chancellor was saying sadly. "Dooku was the only check on Grievous's monstrous lust for slaughter. With Dooku gone, the General has been unleashed to rampage across the galaxy. I'm afraid that, far from being over, this war is about to get a very great deal worse."
"And what of the Sith?" Obi-Wan said. "Dooku's death should have at least begun the weakening of the darkness, but instead it feels stronger than ever."
"I fear Master Yoda's intuition is correct, that Dooku was merely the apprentice to the Sith Lord, not the Master."
Mace started walking toward the small craft dock where the Jedi shuttle would land, and the others fell in with him.
"The Sith Lord, if one still exists, will reveal himself in time. They always do."
He hoped Obi-Wan would take the hint and shut up about it. Mace had no desire to speak openly of the investigation in front of the Supreme Chancellor. The less Palpatine knew, the better.
"A more interesting puzzle is Grievous," he said. "He had you at his mercy, Chancellor, and mercy is not numbered among his virtues. Though we all rejoice that he spared you, I cannot help but wonder why."
Palpatine spread his hands.
"I can only assume the Separatists preferred to have me as a hostage rather than as a martyr. Though it is, of course, impossible to say, it may merely have been a whim of the General. He is notoriously erratic."
"Perhaps the Separatist leadership can restrain him in exchange for certain..."
Mace let his gaze drift casually to a point somewhere above the Chancellor's head.
"Considerations."
"Absolutely not."
Palpatine drew himself up, straightening his robes.
"A negotiated peace would be a recognition of the CIS as the legitimate government of the rebellious systems, tantamount to losing the war. No, Master Windu. This war can end only one way. Unconditional surrender. And while Grievous lives, that will never happen."
"Very well," Mace said. "Then the Jedi will make the capture of General Grievous our particular task."
He glanced at Anakin and Obi-Wan, then back to Palpatine. He leaned close to the Chancellor, and his voice went low and final, with a buried intensity that hinted just the slightest bit of suspicion and warning.
"This war has gone on far too long already. We will find him, and this war will end."
"I have no doubt of it."
Palpatine strolled along, seemingly oblivious.
"But we should never underestimate the deviousness of the Separatists. It is possible that even the war itself has been only one further move, he said with elegant, understated precision, in some greater game.
As the Jedi shuttle swung toward the Chancellor's private landing platform at the Senate offices, Obi-Wan watched Anakin pretending not to stare out the window. On the platform was a small welcome contingent of senators, and Anakin was trying desperately to look as if he wasn't searching that little crowd hungrily for a particular face. The pretense was a waste of time. Anakin radiated excitement so powerfully in the Force that Obi-Wan could practically hear the thunder of his heartbeat. Obi-Wan gave a silent sigh. He had entirely too good an idea whose face his former Padawan was so hoping to see. When the shuttle touched down, Master Windu caught his eye from beyond Anakin's shoulder. The Corran Master made a nearly invisible gesture, to which Obi-Wan did not visibly respond. But when Palpatine and Anakin and R2 all debarked toward the crowd of well-wishers, Obi-Wan stayed behind. Anakin stopped on the landing deck, looking back at Obi-Wan. You coming? I haven't the courage for politics, Obi-Wan said, showing his usual trace of a smile. I'll brief the council. Shouldn't I be there too? No need. This isn't the formal report. Besides, Obi-Wan nodded toward the clot of holonet crews clogging the pedestrian gangway. Someone has to be the poster boy. Anakin looked pained. Poster man. Quite right. Quite right. Obi-Wan said with a gentle chuckle. Go meet your public, poster man. Wait a minute. This whole operation was your idea. You planned it. You led the rescue. It's your turn to take the bows. You won't get out of it that easily, my young friend. Without you, I wouldn't even have made it to the flagship. You killed Count Dooku and single-handedly rescued the Chancellor. All while, I might be forgiven for adding, carrying some old broken-down Jedi Master unconscious on your back. Not to mention making a landing that will be the standard of impossible in every flight manual for the next 1,000 years. Only because of your training, Master. That's just an excuse. You're the hero. Go spend your glorious days surrounded by... Obi-Wan allowed himself a slightly disparaging cough. Politicians. Come on, Master. You owe me. And not just for saving your skin for the 10th time. 9th time. Cato Nymoidia doesn't count. It was your fault in the first place. Obi-Wan waved him off. See you at the Outer Rim briefing in the morning. Well, all right. Just this once. Anakin laughed and waved, and then headed briskly off to catch up with Palpatine as the Chancellor waded into the senators with the smooth-as-oiled transparisteel ease of the lifelong politician. The hatch cycled shut, the shuttle lifted off, and Obi-Wan's smile faded as he turned to Mace Windu. You wanted to speak with me? Windu moved close to Obi-Wan's position by the window, nodding out at the scene on the landing platform. It's Anakin. I don't like his relationship with Palpatine. We've had this conversation before. There is something between them. Something new. I could see it in the Force. Mace's voice was flat and grim. It felt powerful and incredibly dangerous. Obi-Wan spread his hands. I trust Anakin with my life. I know you do. I only wish we could trust the Chancellor with Anakin's. Yes, Obi-Wan said, frowning. Palpatine's policies are sometimes questionable, but he dotes on Anakin like a kindly old uncle on his favorite nephew. Mace stared out the window. The Chancellor loves power. If he has any other passion, I have not seen it. Obi-Wan shook his head with a trace of disbelief. I recall that not so long ago, you were something of an admirer of his. Things, Mace Windu said grimly, change. Flying over a landscape pocked with smoldering wreckage, where once tall buildings filled with living beings had gleamed in the sun, toward a temple filled with memories of so many, many Jedi who would never return from this war, Obi-Wan could not disagree. After a moment, he said, What would you have me do? I am not certain. You know my power. I cannot always interpret what I've seen. Be alert Be mindful of Anakin, and be careful of Palpatine. He is not to be trusted, and his influence on Anakin is dangerous. But Anakin is the chosen one. All the more reason to fear an outsider's influence. We have circumstantial evidence that traces Sidious to Palpatine's inner circle. Suddenly, Obi-Wan had difficulty breathing. Are you certain? Mace shook his head. Nothing is certain. But this raid, the capture of Palpatine, had to be an inside job. And the timing. We were closing in on him, Master Kenobi. The information you and Anakin discovered? We had traced the Sith Lord to an abandoned factory in the works, not far from where Anakin landed the cruiser. When the attack began, we were tracking him through the down-level tunnels. Mace stared out the viewport at a vast residential complex that dominated the skyline to the west. The trail led to the sub-basement of 500 Republica. 500 Republica was the most exclusive address on the planet. Its inhabitants included only the incredibly wealthy or the incredibly powerful, from Wraith Sinar of the Sinar Systems conglomerate to Palpatine himself. Obi-Wan could only say, "Oh, we have to face the possibility, the probability, that what Dooku told you on Geonosis was actually true, that the Senate is under the influence, under the control of Darth Sidious, that it has been for years." Do you? Obi-Wan had to swallow before he could go on. Do you have any suspects? Too many. All we know of Sidious is that he's bipedal, of roughly human conformation. Say Pestage springs to mind. I wouldn't rule out Mass Amidah either. The Sith Lord might even be hiding among the Red Guards. There's no way to know. Who's handling the questioning? Obi-Wan asked. I'd be happy to sit in. My perceptions are not so refined as some, but... May shook his head. Interrogate the Supreme Chancellor's personal aides and advisors? Impossible. But I... Palpatine will never allow it, though he hasn't said so. May stared out the window. I'm not sure he even believes the Sith exist. Obi-Wan blinked. But how can he... Look at it from his point of view. The only real evidence we have is Dooku's word. And he's dead now. The Sith Lord of Naboo. The Zabrak who killed Qui-Gon. May shrugged. Destroyed. As you know. He shook his head. Relations with the Chancellor's office are difficult. I feel he has lost his trust in the Jedi. I have certainly lost my trust in him. But he doesn't have the authority to interfere with a Jedi investigation. Obi-Wan frowned, suddenly uncertain. Does he? The Senate has surrendered so much power, it's hard to say where his authority stops. It's that bad? Mace's jaw locked. The only reason Palpatine's not a suspect is because he already rules the galaxy. But we are closer than we have ever been to rooting out the Sith, Obi-Wan said slowly. That can only be good news. I would think that Anakin's friendship with Palpatine could be of use to us in this. He has the kind of access to Palpatine that other Jedi might only dream of. Their friendship is an asset, not a danger. You can't tell him. I beg your pardon? Of the whole council, only Yoda and myself know how deep this actually goes. And now you. I have decided to share this with you because you are in the best situation to watch Anakin. Watch him. Nothing more. We... Obi-Wan shook his head helplessly. We don't keep secrets from each other. You must keep this one. Mace laced his fingers together and squeezed until his knuckles crackled like blaster fire. Skywalker is arguably the most powerful Jedi alive, and he is still getting stronger. But he is not stable. You know it. We all do. It is why he cannot be given mastership. We must keep him off the council, despite his extraordinary gifts. And Jedi prophecy is not absolute. The less he has to do with Palpatine, the better. But surely... Obi-Wan stopped himself. He thought of how many times Anakin had violated orders. He thought of how unflinchingly loyal Anakin was to anyone he considered a friend. He thought of the danger Palpatine faced unknowingly with a Sith Lord among his advisors. Master Windu was right. This was a secret Anakin could not be trusted to keep. What can I tell him?
Tell him nothing. I sense the dark side around him. Around them both.
As it is around us all, Obi-Wan reminded him. The dark side touches all of us, Master Windu. Even you.
I know that too well, Obi-Wan.
For one second, Obi-Wan saw something raw and haunted in the Koran Master's eyes. Mace turned away.
It is possible that we may have to move against Palpatine.
Move against?
If he is truly under the control of a Sith Lord, it may be the only way.
Obi-Wan's whole body had gone numb. This didn't seem real. It was not possible that he was actually having this conversation.
You haven't been here, Obi-Wan.
Mace stared bleakly down at his hands.
You've been off fighting the war in the Outer Rim. You don't know what it's been like, dealing with all the petty squabbles and special interests and greedy, grasping fools in the Senate, and Palpatine's constant, cynical, ruthless maneuvering for power. He carves away chunks of our freedom and bandages the wounds with tiny scraps of security. And for what? Look at this planet, Obi-Wan. We have given up so much freedom. How secure do we look?
Obi-Wan's heart clenched. This was not the Mace Windu he knew and admired. It was as though the darkness in the Force was so much thicker here on Coruscant that it had breathed poison into Mace's spirit. And perhaps was even breeding suspicion and dissension among the members of the Jedi Council. The greatest danger from the darkness outside came when Jedi fed it with the darkness within. He had feared he might find matters had deteriorated when he returned to Coruscant and the Temple. Not even in his darkest dreams had he thought it would get this bad. Master Windu, Mace, we'll go to Yoda together, he said firmly. And among the three of us, we'll work something out. We will. You'll see.
It may be too late already.
It may be, and it may not be. We can only do what we can do, Mace. A very, very wise Jedi once said to me, we don't have to win. All we have to do is fight. Some of the lines erased themselves from the Koran Master's face then, and when he met Obi-Wan's eye, there was a quirk at the corner of his mouth that might someday develop into a smile. A tired, sad smile, but a smile nonetheless.
I seem, he said slowly, to have forgotten that particular Jedi. Thank you for reminding me.
It was the least I could do, Obi-Wan said lightly, but a sad weight had gathered on his chest. Things change, indeed. Anakin's heart pounded in his throat, but he kept smiling and nodding and shaking hands and trying desperately to work his way toward a familiar golden-domed protocol droid who hung back beyond the crowd of senators, right arm lifted in a small tentative wave at R2-D2. She wasn't here. Why wasn't she here? Something must have happened. He knew, deep in his guts, that something had happened to her. An accident, or she was sick, or she'd been caught in one of the vast number of buildings hit by debris from the battle today. She might be trapped somewhere right now, might be wounded, might be smothering, calling out his name, might be feeling the approach of flames. Stop it, he told himself. She's not hurt. If anything had happened to her, he would know. Even from the far side of the Outer Rim, he would know. So why wasn't she here? Had something... He could barely breathe. He couldn't make himself even think it. He couldn't stop himself from thinking it. Had something changed? For her? In how she felt? He managed to disengage himself from Tundra Domei's clammy grip and insistent invitations to visit his family's deepwater estate in Mon Calamari. He slid past the Molesterian Senator Ask-Ack with an apologetic shrug. He had a different senator on his mind. R2 was weeping and beeping and whistling intensely when Anakin finally struggled free of the mass of sweaty, grasping politicians. C-3PO had turned away dismissively.
It couldn't have been that bad. Don't exaggerate. You're hardly even dented.
R2's answering furoo sounded a little defensive. C-3PO sent a wisp of static through his vocabulator that sounded distinctly like a disapproving sniff.
On that point, I agree. You're long overdue for a tune-up. And, if I may say so, a bath.
3PO! Anakin came up close beside the droid he had built in the back room of his mother's slave hovel on Tatooine. The droid who had been both project and friend through his painful childhood. The droid who now served the woman he loved. 3PO had been with her all these months, had seen her every day, had touched her, perhaps even today. He could feel echoes of her resonating outward from his electroplated shell, and they left him breathless.
"Oh, Master Anakin!"
3PO exclaimed.
"I am very glad to find you well. One does worry when friends fall out of touch. Why, I was saying to the Senator just the other day, or was it last week? Time seems to run together, so... Do you think you might have the opportunity to adjust my internal calendar settings while you're..."
3PO, have you seen her? Anakin was trying so hard not to shout that his voice came out a strangled croak. Where is she? Why isn't she here?
Oh, well, certainly, certainly. Officially, Senator Amidala is extremely busy.
C-3PO said imperturbably.
She has been sequestered all day in the Naboo Embassy, reviewing the new Security Act, preparing for tomorrow's debate.
Anakin couldn't breathe. She wasn't here, hadn't come to meet him over some debate? The Senate. He hated the Senate. Hated everything about it. A red haze gathered inside his head. Those self-righteous, narrow-minded, grubby little squabblers. He'd be doing the galaxy a favor if he were to go over there right now and just... Wait, he murmured, blinking. Did you say, officially?
Oh, yes, Master Anakin.
3PO sounded entirely virtuous.
That is my official answer to all queries regarding the Senator's whereabouts, all afternoon.
The red haze evaporated, leaving only sunlight and dizzyingly fresh air. Anakin smiled. And unofficially? The protocol droid leaned close with an exaggeratedly conspiratorial whisper.
Unofficially, she's waiting in the hallway.
It felt like being struck by lightning. But in a good way. In the best way any man has ever felt since, roughly, the birth of the universe. 3PO gave a slight nod at the other senators and the holonet crews on the gangway.
She thought it best to avoid a public scene, and she wished for me to relate to you that she believes that both of you might avoid a public scene all afternoon, and perhaps all night as well.
3PO! Anakin blinked at him. He felt an irrational desire to giggle. What exactly are you suggesting?
I'm sure I couldn't say, sir. I am only performing as per the Senator's instructions.
You... Anakin shook his head in wonder while his smile grew to a grin he thought might split open his cheeks. You are amazing.
Thank you, Master Anakin. Though credit for that is due largely.
C-3PO made an elegantly gracious bow.
To my creator.
Anakin could only go on grinning. With that, the golden protocol droid laid an affectionate hand on R2's dome.
Come along, R2. I have found the most delightful body shop down in the Liparshan Way.
They moved away, whirring and clanking after the senators who were already off among the holonet crews. Anakin's smile faded as he watched them go. He felt a presence at his shoulder and turned to find Palpatine beside him, with a warm smile and a soft word, as he always seemed to be when Anakin was troubled. "What is it, Anakin?" the Chancellor asked kindly. "Something is disturbing you. I can tell." Anakin shrugged and gave his head a dismissive shake, embarrassed. "It's nothing." "Anakin, anything that might upset a man such as yourself is certainly something. Let me help." "There's nothing you can do. It's just..." Anakin nodded after 3PO and R2. "I was just thinking that, even after all I've done, C-3PO is still the only person I know who calls me master." "Ah, the Jedi Council." Palpatine slid an arm around Anakin's shoulders and gave him a comradely squeeze. "I believe I can be of some use to you in this problem after all." "You can.
I should be very much surprised if I couldn't. Palpatine's smile was still warm, but his eyes had gone distant. You may have noticed that I have a certain gift, he murmured, for getting my way. Chapter 9. Padme. From the shadow of a great pillar, stretching up into the reddening afternoon that leaked through the vaulted roof of transparasteel over the atrium of the Senate office building, she watched senators clustering in through the archway from the Chancellor's landing platform. And then she saw the Chancellor himself, and C-3PO. And yes, that was R2-D2, and so he could not be far behind. And only then did she finally find him among them, tall and straight, his hair radiation bleached to golden streaks, and on his lips a lively smile that opened her chest and unlocked her heart. And she could breathe again. Through the swirl of HoloNet reporters and the chatter of senators and the gently comforting tones of Palpatine's most polished, reassuringly paternal voice, she did not move, not so much as to lift a hand or turn her head. She was silent and still, only letting herself breathe, feeling the beat of her heart. And she could have stood there forever, in the shadows, and had her fondest dreams all fulfilled simply by watching him be alive. But when he moved away from the group, pacing in soft conversation with Bail Organa of Alderaan, and she heard Bail saying something about the end of Count Dooku and the end of the war, and finally an end to Palpatine's police state tactics, her breath caught again, and she held it, because she knew the next thing she heard would be his voice. "I wish that were so," he said, "but the fighting will continue until General Grievous's spare parts. The Chancellor is very clear on this, and I believe the Senate and the Jedi Council will both agree." And beyond that, there was no hope she could be happier, until his eye found her silent, still shadow, and he straightened. And a new light broke over his golden face, and he said, "Excuse me," to the senator from Alderaan. And a moment later, he came to her in the shadows, and they were in each other's arms. Their lips met, and the universe became, one last time, perfect. This is Padme Amidala. She is an astonishingly accomplished young woman, who in her short life has been already the youngest ever elected queen of her planet, a daring partisan guerrilla, and a measured, articulate, and persuasive voice of reason in the Republic Senate. But she is, at this moment, none of these things. She can still play at them. She pretends to be a senator. She still wields the moral authority of a former queen. And she is not shy about using her reputation for fierce physical courage to her advantage in political debate. But her inmost reality, the most fundamental, unbreakable core of her being, is something entirely different. She is Anakin Skywalker's wife. Yet wife is a word too weak to carry the truth of her. Wife is such a small word, such a common word. A word that can come from a downturned mouth with so many petty, unpleasant echoes. For Padme Amidala, saying, "I am Anakin Skywalker's wife," is saying neither more nor less than "I am alive." Her life before Anakin belonged to someone else, some lesser being to be pitied, some poor, impoverished spirit who could never suspect how profoundly life should be lived. Her real life began the first time she looked into Anakin Skywalker's eyes and found him there, not the uncritical worship of little Annie from Tatooine, but the direct, unashamed, smoldering passion of a powerful Jedi. A young man, to be sure, but every centimeter, a man. A man whose legend was already growing within the Jedi Order and beyond. A man who knew exactly what he wanted and was honest enough to simply ask for it. A man strong enough to unroll his deepest feelings before her without fear and without shame. A man who had loved her for a decade with faithful and patient heart, while he waited for the act of destiny he was sure would someday open her own heart to the fire in his. But though she loves her husband without reservation, love does not blind her to his faults,
She is older than he, and wise enough to understand him better than he does himself. He is not a perfect man. He is prideful and moody and quick to anger. But these faults only make her love him the more, for his every flaw is more than balanced by the greatness within him, his capacity for joy and cleansing laughter, his extraordinary generosity of spirit, his passionate devotion not only to her, but also in the service of every living being. He is a wild creature who has come gently to her hand, a vine tiger purring against her cheek. Every softness of his touch, every kind glance or loving word is a small miracle in itself. How can she not be grateful for such gifts? This is why she will not allow their marriage to become public knowledge. Her husband needs to be a Jedi. Saving people is what he was born for. To take that away from him would cripple every good thing in his troubled heart. Now she holds him in their infinite kiss with both arms tight around his neck. Because there is a cold dread in the center of her heart that whispers, this kiss is not infinite at all, that it's only a pause in the headlong rush of the universe. And when it ends, she will have to face the future. And she is terrified. Because while he has been away, everything has changed. Today, here in the hallway of the Senate office building, she brings him news of a gift they have given each other, a gift of joy and of terror. The gift is the edge of a knife that has already cut their past from their future. For these long years, they have held each other only in secret, only in moments stolen from the business of the Republic and the war. Their love has been the perfect refuge. A long, quiet afternoon, warm and sunny, sealed away from fear and doubt, from duty and from danger. But now she carries within her a planetary terminator that will end their warm afternoon forever and leave them blind in the oncoming night. She is more now than Anakin Skywalker's wife. She is the mother of Anakin Skywalker's unborn child. After an all-too-brief eternity, the kiss finally ended. She clung to him, just breathing in the presence of him after so long, murmuring love against his broad, strong chest while he murmured love into the coils of her softly scented hair. Sometime later, she found words again.
Anakin, Anakin, oh my Anakin, I can't believe you're home. They told me,
she almost choked on the memory,
there were whispers that you'd been killed. I couldn't. Every day.
Never believe stories like that, he whispered.
Never. I will always come back to you, Padme. I've lived a year for every hour you were away. It's been a lifetime.
Two. She reached up to the burn scar high on his cheek.
You were hurt.
Nothing serious, he said with a half smile. Just an unfriendly reminder to keep up with my lightsaber practice.
5 months.
It was almost a moan.
5 months? How could they do that to us?
He rested his cheek lightly on the crown of her head. If the Chancellor hadn't been kidnapped, I'd still be out there. It's terrible to say it, but I'm grateful. I'm glad he was kidnapped. It's like it was all arranged just to bring me home again. His arms were so strong and so warm, and his hand touched her hair in the softest caress, as though he was afraid she were as fragile as a dream. And he bent down for another kiss, a new kiss, a kiss that would wipe away every dark dream and all the days and hours and minutes of unbearable dread. But only steps away, the main vault of the atrium still held senators and holonet crews, and the knowledge of the price Anakin would pay when their love became known made her turn her face aside and put her hands on his chest to hold him away.
Anakin, not here. It's too risky.
No, here. Exactly here. He drew her against him again, effortlessly overpowering her half-hearted resistance. I'm tired of the deception, of the sneaking and the lying. We have nothing to be ashamed of.
We love each other, and we are married. Just like trillions of beings across the galaxy. This is something we should shout, not whisper. No, Anakin. Not like all those others. They are not Jedi. We can't let our love force you out of the Order. Force me out of the Order? He smiled down at her fondly. Was that a pun? Anakin. He could still make her angry without even trying. Listen to me. We have a duty to the Republic. Both of us. But yours is now so much more important. You are the face of the Jedi, Anakin. Even after these years of war, many people still love the Jedi, and it's mostly because they love you. Do you understand that? They love the story of you. You're like something out of a bedtime tale. The secret prince, hidden among the peasants, growing up without ever a clue of his special destiny. Except for you, it's all true. Sometimes I think that the only reason the people of the Republic still believe we can win the war is because you're fighting it for them. And it always comes back to politics for you, Anakin said. His smile had gone now. I'm barely even home, and you're already trying to talk me into going back to the war. This isn't about politics, Anakin. It's about you. Something has changed, hasn't it? Thunder gathered in his voice. I felt it, even outside. Something has changed. She lowered her head. Everything has changed. What is it? What? He took her by the shoulders now, his hands hard and irresistibly powerful. There's someone else. I can feel it in the Force. There's someone coming between us. Not the way you think, she said. Anakin, listen. Who is it? Who? Stop it. Anakin, stop. You'll hurt us. His hands sprang open as though she had burned them. He took an unsteady step backward, his face suddenly ashen. Padme, I would never... I'm so sorry, I just... He leaned on the pillar and brought a hand weakly to his eyes. The hero with no fear. What a joke. Padme, I can't lose you. I can't. You're all I live for. Wait. He lifted his head, frowning quizzically. Did you say... us? She reached for him, and he came to meet her hand. Rising tears burned her eyes, and her lip trembled. I'm... Annie. I'm pregnant. She watched him as everything their child would mean cycled through his mind, and her heart caught when she saw, first of all, the wild, almost explosive joy that dawned over his face. Because that meant that, whatever he had gone through on the Outer Rim, he was still her Annie. It meant that the war that had scarred his face had not scarred his spirit. And she watched that joy fade as he began to understand that their marriage could not stay hidden much longer. That even the voluminous robe she wore could not conceal a pregnancy forever. That he would be cast out in disgrace from the Jedi Order. That she would be relieved of her post and recalled to Naboo. That the very celebrity that had made him so important to the war would turn against them both, making them the freshest possible meat for an entire galaxy full of scandalmongers. And she watched him decide that he didn't care. That is, he said slowly, that wild spark returning to his eyes. Wonderful. Padme, that's wonderful. How long have you known? She shook her head. What are we going to do? We're going to be happy. That's what we're going to do. And we're going to be together, all three of us. But, no. He laid a gentle finger on her lips, smiling down at her. No buts. No worries. You worry too much as it is. I have to, she said, smiling through the tears in her eyes. Because you never worry at all. Anakin lurched upright in bed, gasping. Staring blindly into alien darkness. How she had screamed for him. How she had begged for him. How her strength had failed on that alien table. How at the last she could only whimper, Anakin, I'm sorry. I love you. I love you. Thundered inside his head, blinding him to the contours of the night-shrouded room, deafening him to every sound, save the turbo-hammer of his heart. His hand of flesh found unfamiliar coils of sweat-damned silken sheets around his waist. Finally, he remembered where he was. He half-turned, and she was with him, lying on her side, her glorious fall of hair fanned across her pillow, eyes closed, half a smile on her precious lips. And when he saw the long, slow rise and fall of her chest with the cycle of her breathing, he turned away and buried his face in his hands and sobbed. The tears that ran between his fingers then were tears of gratitude. She was alive, and she was with him. In silence so deep he could hear the whirring of the electrodrivers in his mechanical hand, he disentangled himself from the sheets and got up. Through the closet, a long, curving sweep of stairs led to the veranda that overlooked Padme's private landing deck. Leaning on the night-chilled rail, Anakin stared out upon the endless nightscape of Coruscant. It was still burning. Coruscant at night had always been an endless galaxy of light, shining from trillions of windows in billions of buildings that reached kilometers into the sky, with navigation lights and advertising, and the infinite streams of speeders running lights coursing the rivers of traffic lanes overhead. But tonight, local power outages had swallowed ragged swaths of the city into vast nebulae of darkness, broken only by the malignant red dwarf glares of innumerable fires. Anakin didn't know how long he stood there staring. The city looked like he felt. Damaged. Broken in battle. Stained with darkness. And he'd rather look at the city than think about why he was out here looking at it in the first place. She moved more quietly than the smoky breeze, but he felt her approach. She took a place beside him at the railing and laid her soft human hand along the back of his hard mechanical one. And she simply stood with him, staring silently out across the city that had become her second home, waiting patiently for him to tell her what was wrong, trusting that he would. He could feel her patience and her trust, and he was so grateful for both that tears welled once more. He had to blink out at the burning night, and blink again to keep those fresh tears from spilling over onto his cheeks. He put his flesh hand on top of hers and held it gently until he could let himself speak. "It was a dream," he said finally. She accepted this with a slow, serious nod. "Bad? It was like the ones I used to have." He couldn't look at her. "About my mother." Again, a nod, but even slower and more serious. And... He looked down at her small, slim fingers, and he slipped his between them, clasping their two hands into a knot of prayer. "It was about you." Now she turned aside, leaning once more upon the rail, staring out into the night, and in the slowly pulsing rose glow of the distant fires, she was more beautiful than he had ever seen her. "All right," she said softly. "It was about me." Then she simply waited, still trusting. When Anakin could finally make himself tell her, his voice was raw and hoarse, as though he'd been shouting all day. "It was about you dying," he said. "I couldn't stand it. I can't stand it." He couldn't look at her. He looked at the city, at the deck, at the stars, and he found no place he could bear to see. All he could do was close his eyes. "You're going to die in childbirth." "Oh," she said. That was all. She had only a few months left to live. They had only a few months left to love each other. She would never see their child, and all she said was, "Oh." After a moment, the touch of her hand to his cheek brought his eyes open again, and he found her gazing up at him calmly. "And the baby?" He shook his head. "I don't know." She nodded and pulled away, drifting toward one of the veranda chairs. She lowered herself into it and stared down at her hands, clasped together in her lap. He couldn't take it. He couldn't watch her be calm and accepting about her own death. He came to her side and knelt. "It won't happen, Padme. I won't let it. I could have saved my mother a day earlier, an hour. I... He bit down on the rising pain inside him and spoke through clenched teeth. This dream will not become real. She nodded. I didn't think it would. He blinked. You didn't? This is Coruscant, Annie, not Tatooine. Women don't die in childbirth on Coruscant. Not even the Twilighters in the down levels. And I have a top-flight medical droid who assures me I am in perfect health. Your dream must have been some kind of metaphor or something. My dreams are literal, Padme. I wouldn't know a metaphor if it bit me. And I couldn't see the place you were in. You might not even be on Coruscant. She looked away. I had been thinking about going somewhere. Somewhere else. Having the baby in secret to protect you. So you can stay in the Order. I don't want to stay in the Order. He took her face between his palms so that she had to look into his eyes, so that she had to see how much he meant every word he said. Don't protect me. I don't need it. We have to start thinking right now about how we can protect you. Because all I want is for us to be together. And we will be, she said. But there must be more to your dream than death and childbirth. That doesn't make any sense. I know. But I can't begin to guess what it might be. It's too... I can't even think about it, Padme. I'll go crazy. What are we going to do? She kissed the palm of his hand of flesh. We're going to do what you told me when I asked you the same question this afternoon. We're going to be happy together. But we can't just... Wait. I can't. I have to do something. Of course you do. She smiled fondly. That's who you are. That's what being a hero is. What about Obi-Wan? He frowned. What about him? You told me once that he is as wise as Yoda and as powerful as Mace Windu. Couldn't he help us? No. Anakin's chest clenched like a fist squeezing his heart. I can't. I'd have to tell him. He's your best friend, Annie. He must suspect already. It's one thing to have him suspect. It's something else to shove it in his face. He's still on the council. He'd have to report me and... And what? Is there something you haven't told me? He turned away. I'm not sure he's on my side. Your side? Anakin, what are you saying? He's on the Jedi Council, Padme. I know my name has come up for mastery. I'm more powerful than any Jedi Master alive, but someone is blocking me. Obi-Wan could tell me who and why, but he doesn't. I'm not sure he even stands up for me with them. I can't believe that. It has nothing to do with believing, he murmured, softly bitter. It's the truth. There must be some reason, then. Anakin, he's your best friend. He loves you. Maybe he does. But I don't think he trusts me. His eyes went as bleak as the empty night. And I'm not sure we can trust him. Anakin! She clutched at his arm. What would make you say that? None of them trust me, Padme. None of them. You know what I feel when they look at me? Anakin. He turned to her, and everything in him ached. He wanted to cry, and he wanted to rage, and he wanted to make his rage a weapon that would cut himself free forever. Fear, he said. I feel their fear. And for nothing. He could show them something, though. He could show them a reason for their fear. He could show them what he discovered within himself in the General's quarters on Invisible Hand. Something of it must have risen on his face, because he saw a flicker of doubt shadow her eyes just for a second, just a flash. But still, it burned into him like a lightsaber, and he shuddered. And his shudder turned into a shiver that became shaking. And he gathered her to his chest and buried his face in her hair, and the strong, sweet warmth of her cooled him just enough. Padme, he murmured. Oh, Padme, I'm so sorry. Forget I said anything. None of that matters now. I'll be gone from the Order soon. Because I will not let you go away to have our baby in some alien place. I will not let you face my dream alone. I will be there for you, Padme. Always. No matter what. I know it, Annie. I know. She pulled gently away and looked up at him. Tears sparkled like red gems in the firelight. Red, as the synthetic bloodshine of Dooku's lightsaber. He closed his eyes. She said, "Come upstairs, Anakin. The night's getting cold. Come up to our bed." "All right." "All right." He found that he could breathe again, and his shaking had stilled. Just. He put his arm around her shoulder so that he didn't have to meet her eyes. "Just don't say anything to Obi-Wan, all right?" Chapter 10. Masters. Obi-Wan sat beside Mace Windu while they watched Yoda scan the report. Here, in Yoda's simple living space within the Jedi Temple, every softly curving pod chair and knurled organiform table hummed with gentle, comforting power. The same warm strength that Obi-Wan remembered enfolding him even as an infant. These chambers had been Yoda's home for more than 800 years. Everything within them echoed with the harmonic resonance of Yoda's calm wisdom, tuned through centuries of his touch. To sit within Yoda's chambers was to inhale serenity. To Obi-Wan, this was a great gift in these troubled times. But when Yoda looked at them through the translucent shimmer of the holo-projected report on the contents of the latest amendment to the Security Act, his eyes were anything but calm. They had gone narrow and cold, and his ears had flattened back along his skull.
"This report, from where does it come?"
"The Jedi still have friends in the Senate," Mace Windu replied in his grim monotone. "For now."
"When presented this amendment is passed, it will be?"
Mace nodded. "My source expects passage by acclamation. Overwhelming passage. Perhaps as early as this afternoon."
"Chancellor's goal in this, unclear to me it is,"
Yoda said slowly.
"Though nominally in command of the Council, the Senate may place him. The Jedi he cannot control. Moral, our authority has always been. Much more than merely legal. Simply follow orders, Jedi do not."
"I don't think he intends to control the Jedi," Mace said. "By placing the Jedi Council under the control of the Office of the Supreme Chancellor, this amendment will give him the constitutional authority to disband the Order itself."
"Surely you cannot believe this is his intention."
"His intention?" Mace said darkly. "Perhaps not. But his intentions are irrelevant. All that matters now is the intent of the Sith Lord who has our government in his grip. And the Jedi Order may be all that stands between him and galactic domination. What do you think he will do?"
"Authority to disband the Jedi, the Senate would never grant."
"The Senate will vote to grant exactly that, this afternoon."
"The implications of this, they must not comprehend."
"It no longer matters what they comprehend," May said. "They know where the power is."
"But even disbanded, even without legal authority, still Jedi we would be. Jedi Knights served the Force long before there was a Galactic Republic. And serve it we will when this Republic is but dust."
"Master Yoda, that day may be coming sooner than any of us think. That day may be today." Mace shot a frustrated look at Obi-Wan, who picked up his cue smoothly. "We don't know what the Sith Lord's plans may be," Obi-Wan said. "But we can be certain that Palpatine is not to be trusted. Not anymore. This draft resolution is not the product of some overzealous senator. We may be sure Palpatine wrote it himself and passed it along to someone he controls to make it look like the Senate is once more forcing him to reluctantly accept extra powers in the name of security. We are afraid that they will continue to do so until one day he's forced to reluctantly accept dictatorship for life."
"I am convinced this is the next step in a plot aimed directly at the heart of the Jedi," Mace said. "This is a move toward our destruction. The dark side of the Force surrounds the Chancellor."
Obi-Wan added,
as it has surrounded and cloaked the Separatists since even before the war began. If the Chancellor is being influenced through the dark side, this whole war may have been, from the beginning, a plot by the Sith to destroy the Jedi Order.
Speculation!
Yoda thumped the floor with his gimmer stick, making his hover chair bob gently.
On theories such as these, we cannot rely. Proof we need. Proof.
Proof may be a luxury we cannot afford. A dangerous light had entered Mace Windu's eyes. We must be ready to act.
Act? Obi-Wan asked mildly.
He cannot be allowed to move against the Order. He cannot be allowed to prolong the war needlessly. Too many Jedi have died already. He is dismantling the Republic itself. I have seen life outside the Republic. So have you, Obi-Wan. Slavery. Torture. Endless war.
Mace's face darkened with the same distant, haunted shadow Obi-Wan had seen him wear the day before.
I have seen it in Nar Shadda, and I saw it on Harun Kal. I saw what it did to Deepa and to Sora Bulk. Whatever its flaws, the Republic is our sole hope for justice and for peace. It is our only defense against the dark. Palpatine may be about to do what the Separatists cannot. Bring down the Republic. If he tries, he must be removed from office.
Removed? Obi-Wan said. You mean arrested?
Yoda shook his head.
To a dark place, this line of thought will lead us. Great care we must take.
The Republic is civilization. It's the only one we have.
Mace looked deeply into Yoda's eyes and into Obi-Wan's, and Obi-Wan could feel the heat in the Koran Master's gaze.
We must be prepared for radical action. It is our duty.
But, Obi-Wan protested numbly, you're talking about treason.
I'm not afraid of words, Obi-Wan. If it's treason, then so be it. I would do this right now if I had the Council's support. The real treason, Mace said, would be failure to act.
Such an act. Destroy the Jedi Order it could,
Yoda said.
Lost the trust of the public we have already.
No disrespect, Master Yoda. Mace interrupted. But that's a politician's argument. We can't let public opinion stop us from doing what's right.
Convinced it is right, I am not,
Yoda said severely.
Working behind the scenes we should be, to uncover Lord Sidious. To move against Palpatine while the Sith still exist. This may be part of the Sith plan itself. To turn the Senate and the public against the Jedi. So that we are not only disbanded, but outlawed.
Mace was half out of his pod. To wait gives the Sith the advantage.
Have the advantage already, they do.
Yoda jabbed at him with his gimmer stick.
Increase their advantage we will if in haste we act.
Masters, masters, please, Obi-Wan said. He looked from one to the other and inclined his head respectfully. Perhaps there is a middle way.
Ah, of course. Kenobi the negotiator.
Mace Windu settled back into his seating pod.
I should have guessed. That is why you asked for this meeting, isn't it? To mediate our differences, if you can.
So sure of your skills you are.
Yoda folded his fists around the head of his stick.
Easy to negotiate, this matter is not.
Obi-Wan kept his head down.
It seems to me, he said carefully, that Palpatine himself has given us an opening. He has said, both to you, Master Windu, and in the Holonet address he gave following his rescue, that General Grievous is the true obstacle to peace. Let us forget about the rest of the Separatist leadership for now. Let Newt Gunray and San Hill and the rest run wherever they like, while we put every available Jedi and all of our agents, the whole of Republic intelligence if we can, to work on locating Grievous himself. This will force the hand of the Sith Lord. He will know that Grievous cannot elude our full efforts for long, once we devote ourselves exclusively to his capture. It will draw Sidious out. He will have to make some sort of move. If he wishes the war to continue.
If, Mace said. The war has been a Sith operation from the beginning, with Dooku on one side and Sidious on the other. It has always been a plot aimed at us, at the Jedi, to bleed us dry of our youngest and best, to make us into something we were never intended to be.
He shook his head bitterly. I had the truth in my hands years ago, back on Harun Kal, in the first months of the war. I had it, but I did not understand how right I was.
Seen glimpses of this truth we all have,
Yoda said sadly.
Our arrogance it is, which has stopped us from fully opening our eyes.
Until now, Obi-Wan put in gently. We understand now the goal of the Sith Lord. We know his tactics, and we know where to look for him. His actions will reveal him. He cannot escape us. He will not escape us.
Yoda and Mace frowned at each other for one long moment. Then both of them turned to Obi-Wan and inclined their heads in mirrors of his respectful bow.
Seen to the heart of the matter, young Kenobi has.
Mace nodded. Yoda and I will remain on Coruscant, monitoring Palpatine's advisors and lackeys. We'll move against Sidious the instant he is revealed. But who will capture Grievous? I have fought him blade to blade. He is more than a match for most Jedi.
We'll worry about that once we find him, Obi-Wan said. A slight wistful smile crept over his face. If I listen hard enough, I can almost hear Qui-Gon reminding me that until the possible becomes actual, it is only a distraction.
General Grievous stood wide-legged, hands folded behind him, as he stared out through the reinforced viewport at the towering sphere of the Geonosian dreadnought. The immense ship looked small, though, against the scale of the vast sinkhole that rose around it. This was Utapau, a remote backworld on the fringe of the Outer Rim. At ground level, far above where Grievous stood now, the planet appeared to be a featureless ball of barren rock, scoured flat by endless hyperwinds. From orbit, though, its cities and factories and spaceports could be seen as the planet's rotation brought its cavernous sinkholes one at a time into view. These sinkholes were the size of inverted mountains, and every available square meter of their interior walls was packed with city, and every square meter of every city was under the guns of separatist war droids, making sure that the Utapauans behaved themselves. Utapau had no interest in the Clone Wars. It had never been a member of the Republic, and had carefully maintained a stance of quiet neutrality, right up until Grievous had conquered it. Neutrality in these times was a joke. A planet was neutral only so long as neither the Republic nor the Confederacy wanted it. If Grievous could laugh, he would have. The members of the Separatist leadership scurried across the permacrete landing platform like the alley rats they were, scampering for the ship that would take them to the safety of the newly constructed base on Mustafar. But one alley rat was missing from the scuttle. Grievous shifted his gaze fractionally and found the reflection of Newt Gunray in the transparasteel. The Nymoidian viceroy stood dithering in the control center's doorway. Grievous regarded the reflection of the bulbous, cold-blooded eyes below the tall, peaked mitre.
Gunray!
He made no other motion.
Why are you still here?
Something should be said privately, General.
The Viceroy's reflection cast glances either way along the hallway beyond the door.
I am disturbed by this new move. You told us that Utapau would be safe for us. Why is the Leadership Council being moved now to Mustafar?
Grievous sighed. He had no time for lengthy explanations. He was expecting a secret transmission from Sidious himself. He could not take the transmission with Gunray in the room, nor could he follow his natural inclinations and boot the Nymoidian Viceroy so high he'd burn up on re-entry. Grievous still hoped every day that Lord Sidious would give him leave to smash the skulls of Gunray and his toady Roon Hako. Repulsive, sniveling, grub-greedy scum, both of them. and the rest of the Separatist leadership was every bit as vile. But for now, a pretense of cordiality had to be maintained.
Utapau,
Grievous said slowly, as though explaining to a child,
is a hostile planet under military occupation. It was never intended to be more than a stopgap. While the defenses of the base on Mustafar were completed, now that they are, Mustafar is the most secure planet in the galaxy. The stronghold prepared for you can withstand the entire Republic Navy.
It should, Gunray muttered. Construction nearly bankrupted the Trade Federation.
Don't whine to me about money, Viceroy. I have no interest in it.
You had better, General. It's my money that finances this entire war. It's my money that pays for that body you wear, and for those insanely expensive Magna Guards of yours. It's my money!
Grievous moved so swiftly that he seemed to teleport from the window to half a meter in front of Gunray.
How much use is your money?
He said, flexing his hand of jointed duranium in the Nymordian's face.
Against this?
Gunray flinched and backed away.
I was only... I have some concerns about your ability to keep us safe, General, that's all. The Trade Federation, cannot work in a climate of fear. What about the Jedi?
Forget the Jedi. They do not enter into this equation.
They will be entering into that base soon enough.
The base is secure. It can stand against 1,000 Jedi. 10,000.
Do you hear yourself? Are you mad?
What I am,
Grievous replied evenly,
is unaccustomed to having my orders challenged.
We are the Leadership Council. You cannot give us orders. We give the orders here.
Are you certain of that? Would you care to wager?
Grievous leaned close enough that he could see the reflection of his mask in Gunray's rose-colored eyes.
Shall we, say, bet your life on it?
Gunray kept on backing away.
You tell us we'll be safe on Mustafar, but you also told us you would deliver Palpatine as a hostage, and he managed to escape your grip.
Be thankful, Viceroy,
Grievous said, admiring the smooth flexion of his finger joints, as though his hand were some species of exotic predator.
That you have not found yourself in my grip.
He went back to the viewport and reassumed his original position, legs wide, hands clasped behind his back. To look on the sickly pink in Gunray's pale green cheeks for 1 second longer was to risk forgetting his orders and splattering the Viceroy's brains from here to Ord Mantell.
Your ship is waiting.
His auditory sensors clearly picked up the slither of Gunray's sandals retreating along the corridor. And not a second too soon, his sensors were also registering the whine of the control center's holocom warming up. He turned to face the disk, and when the annunciator chimed to indicate the incoming transmission, he pressed the accept key and knelt. Head down, he could see only the scanned image of the hem of the great Lord's robes. But that was all he needed to see.
Yes, Lord Zilius.
Have you moved the Separatist Council to Mustafar?
Yes, Master.
He risked a glance out the viewport. Most of the Council had reached the starship. Gunray should be joining them any second. Grievous had seen firsthand how fast the Viceroy could run, given proper motivation.
This ship will lift off within moments.
Well done, my General. Now you must turn your hand to preparing our trap there on Utapau. The Jedi hunt you personally at last. You must be ready for their attack.
Yes, Master.
I am arranging matters to give you a second chance to do my bidding, Grievous. Expect that the Jedi sent to capture you will be Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Kenobi?
Grievous's fists clenched hard enough that his carpal electro-drivers whined in protest.
And Skywalker?
I believe Skywalker will be otherwise engaged.
Grievous dropped his head even lower.
I will not fail you again, my master. Kenobi will die.
See to it.
Master, if I may trouble you with boldness, Why did you not let me kill Chancellor Palpatine? We may never get a better chance.
The time was not yet ripe. Patience, my general. The end of the war is near, and victory is certain.
Even with the loss of Count Dooku?
Dooku was not lost. He was sacrificed. A strategic sacrifice, as one offers up a piece in the Jarrick, to draw the opponent into a fatal blunder.
I was never much the Dajaric player, my master. I prefer real war.
And you shall have your fill, I promise you.
This fatal blunder you speak of, if I may once again trouble you with boldness...
You will come to understand soon enough.
Grievous could hear the smile in his master's voice.
All will be clear once you meet my new apprentice.
Anakin finger-combed his hair as he trotted out across the restricted landing deck atop the temple ziggurat near the base of the High Council Tower. Far across the expanse of deck stood the Supreme Chancellor's shuttle. Anakin squinted at it and at the two tall red-robed guards that stood flanking its open access ramp. And coming toward him from the direction of the shuttle, shielding his eyes and leaning against the morning wind that whipped across the unprotected field, was that Obi-Wan? Finally, Anakin muttered. He'd scoured the temple for his former master. He'd nearly given up hope of finding him when a passing Padawan had mentioned that he'd seen Obi-Wan on his way out to the landing deck to meet Palpatine's shuttle. He hoped Obi-Wan wouldn't notice he hadn't changed his clothes. It wasn't like he could explain. Though his secret couldn't last, he wasn't ready for it to come out just yet. He and Padme had agreed last night that they would keep it as long as they could. He wasn't ready to leave the Jedi Order, not while she was still in danger. Padme had said that his nightmare must be only a metaphor, but he knew better. He knew that Force prophecy was not absolute, but his had never been wrong. Not in the slightest detail. He had known as a boy that he would be chosen by the Jedi. He had known his adventures would span the galaxy. As a mere 9-year-old, long before he even understood what love was, he had looked upon Padme Amidala's flawless face and seen there that she would love him, and that they would someday marry. There had been no metaphor in his dreams of his mother, screaming in pain, tortured to death. I knew you would come to me, Annie. I missed you so much. He could have saved her. Maybe. It had always seemed so obvious to him that if he had only returned to Tatooine a day earlier, an hour, he could have found his mother and she would still be alive. And yet, the great prophets of the Jedi had always taught that the gravest danger in trying to prevent a vision of the future from coming to pass is that in doing so, a Jedi can actually bring it to pass. As though, if he'd run away in time to save his mother, he might have made himself somehow responsible for her death. As though, if he tried to save Padme, he could end up, blankly impossible though it was, killing her himself. But to do nothing? To simply wait for Padme to die? Could something be more than impossible? When a Jedi had a question about the deepest subtleties of the Force, there was one source to whom he could always turn. And so, first thing that morning, without even taking time to stop by his own quarters for a change of clothing, Anakin had gone to Yoda for advice. He'd been surprised by how graciously the ancient Jedi Master had invited him into his quarters, and by how patiently Yoda had listened to his stumbling attempts to explain his question without giving away his secret. Yoda had never made any attempt to conceal what had always seemed to Anakin to be a gruff disapproval of Anakin's very existence. But this morning, despite clearly having other things on his mind, even Anakin's Force perceptions, far from the most subtle, had detected echoes of conflict and worry within the Master's chamber. Yoda had simply offered Anakin a place on one of the softly rounded pod seats and suggested that they meditate together. He hadn't even asked for details. Anakin had been so grateful and so relieved and so unexpectedly hopeful that he'd found tears welling into his eyes, and some few minutes had been required for him to compose himself into proper Jedi serenity. After a time, Yoda's eyes had slowly opened, and the deep furrows of his ancient brow had deepened further.
Premonitions. Premonitions. Deep questions they are. Sense the future, once all Jedi could. Now few alone have this skill. Visions, gifts from the Force, and curses, signposts and snares. These visions of yours...
They are of pain, Anakin had said, of suffering. He had barely been able to make himself add, and death.
In these troubled times, no surprise this is. Yourself, you see, or someone you know.
Anakin had not trusted himself to answer.
Someone close to you?
Yoda had prompted gently. Yes, Anakin had replied, eyes turned away from Yoda's too wise stare. Let him think he was talking about Obi-Wan. It was close enough. Yoda's voice was still gentle and understanding.
The fear of loss is a path to the dark side, young one.
I won't let my visions come true, Master. I won't.
Rejoice for those who transform into the Force. Mourn them not. Miss them not.
Then why do we fight at all, Master? Why save anybody?
Speaking of anybody, we are not.
Yoda had said sternly.
Speaking of you and your vision and your fear, we are. The shadow of greed, attachment is. What you fear to lose, train yourself to release. Let go of fear, and loss cannot harm you.
Which was when Anakin had realized Yoda wasn't going to be any help at all. The greatest sage of the Jedi Order had nothing better to offer him than more pious babble about letting things pass out of his life, like he hadn't heard that a million times already. Easy for him. Who had Yoda ever cared about, really cared about? Of one thing Anakin was certain, the ancient master had never been in love. Or he would have known better than to expect Anakin to just fold his hands and close his eyes and settle in to meditate while what was left of Padme's life evaporated like the ghost mist of dew in a Tatooine winter dawn. So all that had been left for him was to find some way to respectfully extricate himself. And then go find Obi-Wan. Because he wasn't about to give up. Not in this millennium. The Jedi Temple was the greatest nexus of Force energy in the Republic. Its ziggurat design focused the Force the way a lightsaber's gemstone focused its energy stream. With the thousands of Jedi and Padawans within it every day contemplating peace, seeking knowledge, and meditating on justice and surrender to the will of the Force, the temple was a fountain of the light. Just being on its rooftop landing deck sent a surge of power through Anakin's whole body. If the Force was ever to show him a way to change the dark future of his nightmares, it would do so here. The Jedi Temple also contained the Archives, the vast library that encompassed the Order's entire 25 millennia of existence. Everything, from the widest-ranging cosmographical surveys to the intimate journals of a billion Jedi Knights. It was there Anakin hoped to find everything that was known about prophetic dreams, and everything that was known about preventing these prophecies from coming to pass. His only problem was that the deepest secrets of the greatest masters of the Force were stored in restricted holocrons. Since the Lorian-Nott affair, some 70 standard years before, access to these holocrons was denied to all but Jedi masters. And he couldn't exactly explain to the Archives Master why he wanted them. But now here was Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan would help him. Anakin knew he would. If only Anakin could figure out the right way to ask. While he was still hunting for words, Obi-Wan reached him. You missed the report on the Outer Rim sieges. I was held up, Anakin said. I have no excuse. That, at least, was true. Is Palpatine here? Anakin asked. It was a convenient enough way to change the subject. Has something happened?
Quite the opposite,
Obi-Wan said. That shuttle did not bring the Chancellor. It is waiting to bring you to him.
Waiting? For me?
Anakin frowned. Worries and lack of sleep had his head full of fog. He couldn't make this make sense. He patted his robes vacantly. But my beacon hasn't gone off. If the Council wanted me, why didn't they...
The Council, Obi-Wan said, has not been consulted.
I don't understand.
Nor do I.
Obi-Wan stepped close, nodding minutely back toward the shuttle. They simply arrived some time ago. When the deck duty Padawans questioned them, they said the Chancellor has requested your presence.
Why wouldn't he go through the Council?
Perhaps he has some reason to believe, Obi-Wan said carefully, that the Council might have resisted sending you. Perhaps he did not wish to reveal his reason for this summons. Relations between the Council and the Chancellor are stressed. A queasy knot began to tie itself behind Anakin's ribs.
Obi-Wan, what's going on? Something's wrong, isn't it?
You know something, I can tell.
No, no. Only suspect.
Which is not at all the same thing.
Anakin remembered what he'd said to Padme about exactly that last night. The queasy knot tightened.
And that's why I am out here, Anakin, so I can talk to you. Privately. Not as a member of the Jedi Council. In fact, if the Council were to find out about this conversation, well, let's say I'd rather they didn't.
What conversation? I still don't know what's going on.
None of us does. Not really. Obi-Wan put a hand on Anakin's shoulder and frowned deeply into his eyes.
Anakin, you know I am your friend.
Of course you are.
No. No of courses, Anakin. Nothing is of course anymore. I am your friend, and as your friend, I am asking you, be wary of Palpatine.
What do you mean?
I know you are his friend.
I am concerned that he may not be yours.
Be careful of him, Anakin, and be careful of your own feelings.
Careful? Don't you mean mindful?